This week on Underdogs, we're looking at which NBA teams have the legs to pull off a first-round upset, and then we go to our four-legged friends and try to figure out who will win the Kentucky Derby.
The cry goes up both far and near for Underdog.
Underdog.
Countdown going on right now. Morrow, up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. You believe in miracles? Yes!
By George, the dream is alive.
Underdog.
Then I guess there's only one thing left to do. Win the whole fucking thing.
It's the Underdogs back with you for another exciting sports extravaganza. I'm your host, Jordan Brenner, joined as always by the best co-host in the business, Peter Keating. Peter, how are you?
I guess you could say we're back in the saddle, Jordan.
That's right, because a little bit later in the show, we're going to introduce you to a new character, Railbird Keating. He's been studying all the important factors for the Kentucky Derby. He's sipping mint juleps. He's wearing a crazy hat. So we're going to get to that later. But first, Peter, NBA playoffs are in full swing. Last night was a crazy, crazy night that really sort of changed how we're going to view this first round going the rest of the way. I'm struggling to process all of it after we saw the Knicks collapse. We saw the Bucks jump back in the series. What the hell's going on?
I sidestepped your question before about how I am, because I am not doing well, Jordan. I am a Knicks fan who just watched Tyrese Maxey score. You check me on the exact number, but I believe it was 46 points in the last 30 seconds of the game to beat the Knicks on a couple of really incredible plays. So I don't want to take a great shot away from a great player. He's been unbelievable. And actually, the biggest surprise of this whole playoffs to me so far has been the superstar max effort, max production play of Maxey. But we really are right on the verge of a couple of series tilting that now we're tilting one way, completely crashing the other way. So it's exciting, but it's also, good Lord, it's nerve-wracking.
Yes. So big picture, the West is pretty much, you know, done for now, right? You've got, already you have the Nuggets set up to face the Timberwolves, and I want to get into that series in a little bit. You have the Nuggets set to face the Timberwolves in a series we're going to get into in a little bit. Meanwhile, you have the Thunder waiting on the winner of the only competitive series in the West. That's the Clippers against the Mavericks. But the East is a mess. We assume the Celtics are going to dispose of a just completely banged up and done Miami Heat team. But you've got 3-3-2 series. The Knicks, the Sixers, the Bucks, Pacers, and that Magic Cavs non-scoring series. And that's the other big story, Peter, early in these playoffs, is we know scoring started to decline in the second half of the regular season. We know referees were calling fewer fouls. There were fewer free throws. That's been looked at as the biggest change in terms of allowing more physical play. But here are some stats in the playoffs. It's even more pronounced, okay? Last year, in the first round of the playoffs, there were 43 games, so 86 team scores, right?
Mm-hmm.
19 of those 86 times a team scored below 100. So that's 22% of the time. And three total games featured teams that both scored under 100 points. So 7% of the 43 games. Okay. This year, there have been 36 first round games so far. 72 scores. 26 times teams have been held below 100 points. That's 36% of the time. Way up from last year, and six full games, twice as many as last year, in fewer games, have ended with both teams under 100. So you're starting to see scores that resemble more typical playoff games as opposed to last year when it was still like 120s, the teens, even up to 130. What are you thinking of this? How is it changing the way you're watching the NBA? Do you think it helps underdogs at all?
So back in the 90s, there was either a pizza or a taco place that ran a promotion in Madison Square Garden that said anytime the Knicks held an opponent to under 90 points, they'd get free food, free slice of pizza or a taco, whatever it was. Then they started doing that every single night. So the place lowered its promotion to 80 points. Knicks had to hold someone under 80 to get the free pizza slice. This is what that is reminding me of, which is that you calibrate your entire expectation way down. And what's doing is it's hurting teams that ran like wild, scored 100 or 115 or 120 points at will early in the season and expected to be able to carry that play over. Teams that are really fast or really physical on defense are being helped a lot by this. Orlando and Indiana are both being helped by this. I think Minnesota was helped by this a lot against Phoenix, because all of a sudden the physical presence of Minnesota was even more effective against the small ball of Phoenix than we thought. The Union both like Minnesota to begin with, but Minnesota wiped them out in part because Phoenix could not get anything going that involved anything physical at all. So I think it is helping particular teams. I'm not sure that's what's making a difference in the Milwaukee or Philly, New York series.
No, but I agree. I mean, Indiana, for instance, is a very fast paced team anyway. So is Milwaukee, and those scores are high still. But we've seen, you've mentioned that the Cleveland Orlando series is like a mid early 2000s, you know, 96, yes. 86 games, 97, 83. I want to harp on a team you just mentioned, though, because I think this is where it gets interesting, is the next round, Minnesota against Denver. We've talked a lot about how we enjoy when teams zig when others zag, right? And for yes. Minnesota, that was playing two bigs, and it didn't work so well last year, but they've stuck with it. We talked about how the lineups featuring both Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns were significantly better this season.
Yes.
And the question is always, are teams going to be able to play Rudy Gobert off the floor in the playoffs? Well, if you can be more physical and right. it's a little bit less of a pace and space game, that makes it that much harder. And now it's fascinating to see what Jokic is going to be able to do or not do against Gobert, what Denver's ball movement, player movement, and two-man games will be able to do. They split the season series 2-2, but if Minnesota can be more physical, can stay big, I think they've got a real upset chance. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree, and I think it's particularly important because Karl Anthony Towns is coming off the meniscus injury. So in the first three games of the series against Phoenix, he was limited to 24, 27 minutes a game. But that did not mean that they tried to match Phoenix in going smaller or play Kyle Anderson more. No, they put more guys in to shoot more often and stayed physical. And McDaniels and Alexander Walker took turns scoring at a great clip, 16, 18, 25 points a night. They've been able to keep, and then by game four, Towns was back up to 34, 35 minutes a game. So they were able to keep this style going, even when the matchup, even when injury suggested that they were going to have to adjust. They've kept this experiment going. And I think you're right. In this environment, it's a kind of a big boost to them. I love watching this team play for exactly the same reason you outlined, which is that they play different. They believe in something. They're sticking to it. I want to ask you something, though.
Sure.
Minnesota is one of those teams, like many, the only other example I can think of are the Knicks, because it's happened with Thibodeau so many years where players on his teams have led the league in minutes played. Minnesota plays everyone all the time, right? They were famous for not resting players during the season. Can this wear down a max effort team, or do you expect the very physical teams have gotten that way because of their conditioning, and that fatigue and getting banged up, a possibility of injury, isn't going to be more of a factor? Because that's the thing that concerns me in this environment, where it's a lot more banging around that go, a lot more fouls that go uncalled, a lot less space to work in. Are the big physical teams more likely to get tired or hurt?
I don't think playing physical will make you more tired. Look, the Wolves have the best defense in the league. I don't think that, you know, that's not going to go away. That's not going to go away because they're deeper in the season. It's schematic. It's player based. And honestly, in the regular season, you know, their minutes weren't crazy. I mean, yeah, Anthony Edwards played 35 minutes a night and Rudy Gobert played 34 minutes a night, but they played a bunch of guys over 20. They have some depth. I don't think it's not like a crazy Thibodeau like situation. And they still played their bench guys in the playoffs.
You just made the first mention of Edwards, who's averaging what, 38-6 in this series. I mean, in addition to the big men, they got this emerging huge superstar. So,
well, that's the thing. So he has taken this incredible leap. The other thing I'm going to point out is the Timberwolves. I'm going to throw it to our college basketball analysis a little bit. The Timberwolves have a little chameleon ability, and I'll tell you why. Okay. According to the amazing stats site, Ben Fox, Cleaning the Glass, Timberwolves were only 20th in the NBA in three-point shooting frequency. Okay, everyone shoots a lot of threes, but they weren't up at the Celtics level of like 43%. Like they were in like 35% of their shots were from three. But they led the NBA outside of heaves in three-point accuracy. So whenever you have a team that makes a lot of threes and doesn't take as many as others, there's room for growth. So in a situation where you're the underdog, they could dial up the variance a little more, take more threes. Now, that's not the way they play, but they really do have some outstanding shooters led by their top two scorers, Towns and Edwards. So all of this is a really long-winded way to say that I think they're much better positioned than they were against the Nuggets last year. But I still think the Nuggets are going to win the series.
Well, you know, after watching what happened to Anthony Davis, who played pretty well most of the time, but just got destroyed by Jokic. I mean, how much of what happened to the Lakers is just the lack of coaching, the lack of depth? I mean, expecting Austin Reeves to go up with the likes of the Nuggets and the Nuggets better depth. I mean, how much of it is just we should have seen it coming? Because it gets me a little worried if you or I on one side of an argument and the whole world is saying, oh, you know, we are surprised that Minnesota handled Phoenix this way. And we're just surprised that Denver handled the Lakers this way. I'm kind of not surprised. We've been on the T-Wolves for a long time. And why would we get off now?
Yeah, but I'm not sure who's surprised Denver handled the Lakers this way. They're the defending NBA championships. They're a great team. They have arguably the best player on the planet and two guys who play off him beautifully in Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr., a versatile, all-round, do-everything, defend guy in Aaron Gordon. They're a beautifully constructed team. They don't have a lot of depth. You want to talk about depth, that's Denver's problem. But that starting five is just exquisitely constructed. They complement each other beautifully. And I still think they're going to win the championship. But I don't know what the hell is going to happen in the East. Peter, I know you're mourning the Knicks right now, but can you think of one team remaining in the East that's even going to pose a slight challenge to Boston going forward? Like maybe Milwaukee, if they somehow rebound from this 3-2 deficit, get Lillard and Giannis back, and there's something there. But do you see anything going on? Is there an East underdog with legs?
Sometimes when you get a deserving number one seed who cuts through the first round or two of the playoffs, you tend to just stop talking about them. Like we haven't mentioned the Thunder, for example. I mean, Boston is an overwhelming favorite for good reason. And, you know, we've said this many times, the one thing that they didn't do well or they needed more of, they addressed by getting Porzingis, right? And they're taking care of business. And I don't think there's any reason to expect them not to. I do think if it comes to it, a Knicks-Celtics series will be entertaining. I don't think this Sixers run is anything for anybody to be too concerned about. We don't know yet, as of the time we're talking right now, what's going to happen. But as a Knicks fan, you get 1 4-point play in a lifetime, right? The Sixers just had theirs. They stole a game. The Knicks stole a game earlier in the series. And, you know, apart from Joel Embiid's surprisingly dirty play, you know, what you see is what you get. The Knicks are probably the better team. And it's a gut-wrenching loss to go through in this collapse. But it was a bunch of flukes. There's no reason to expect the Knicks not to take care of the Celtics.
First of all, these games against Philly have all been close. It's not like they're blowing them out. So I think you're way overrating the Knicks' chances of surviving the series. The biggest thing for Boston, look, the Porzingis injury matters. But still, like, the Celtics are minus 200 to win the East. And I think there's still value there. These teams are just not even at their level. The Knicks
Porzingis, by the way, is going to be back in time for the next round, right? I mean, he's out for a few
I don't think
days.
So. I'd be surprised, but we'll see. Well, the info is still coming in. I was reading something from Jeff Stotts online, who's so great with NBA injuries. And, you know, I thought he said it'd be more of a couple week thing like Giannis had, but the Knicks are the second team at plus 425, and then it jumps all the way to win the East to the Pacers at plus 1,100. Like, there's just, you know, you could really see, as much as I love Denver, like, the five teams remaining in the West, like, they all have a potential to get hot and do something. The Celtics are just so much better than these other teams. And, like, the most disappointing one to me is Cleveland, because there's a lot of talent there, and they are just playing down right now to level their competition. I love Orlando. I love what they're building. They're pesky. They're well coached. But this shouldn't be as tight a series as it's been. And I just don't have any confidence in Cleveland going up against Boston.
And so with my remaining 20 seconds or whatever, let me throw one. I've done this before. Let me throw a pitch in to appreciate what Dallas is doing. Dallas is now tied with the Clippers. Dallas not likely to go too much further. If they manage to win this series, it'll be have been a great season. But the Clippers have, you know, the Clippers have thrown everything they can at Luka, and Luka is playing out of his mind. In game two of this series, it's the primary defender, okay? People shooting, Clippers shooting against Luka were 2 of 16. I mean, he's grabbing massive rebounds. And not only that, their experiment of trying to find big men who can defend has been working. I mean, PJ Washington plus 23 in the last game.
Why is it a successful season for them if they have a nice series against the Clippers?
Because they won 50 games and they re-engineered their team in the middle of the season on the fly. And because they have to go through this gauntlet you've been talking about in the West.
You have a transcendent superstar in Luka Doncic. You've got a guy making $1 zillion with playoff, with caliber, you know, success in his past, and Kyrie Irving. That's, you're setting the bar way too low for what this team should be hoping to accomplish.
Okay, well then fine. I'll predict they'll beat the Clippers and give Oklahoma City some fits. But the last time I brought up Dallas, you were like, yeah, well, they just beat the Wizards. You were so down on Dallas right after the trades when I said, watch for Kyrie and Luka to work well together because they have big men who can defend now. And you were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, let's not call them the next Nuggets. And I was like, okay. I was just trying to hedge a little bit for my own safety, but I like Dallas and I like what they've been doing.
Yeah, no, I think the PJ Washington move was really savvy. And he's just fit in perfectly there. And you can also sort of see where they're headed if Derek Lively continues to develop.
Yes.
You know, he is the perfect sort of modern Tyson Chandler, rim running, shot blocking, defensive big man. It's question, you know, it's
keeps
always
things lively on the defensive end. That's a good slogan.
Oh, you're such a dope. Well, speaking of lively, we're going to get into some lively horse racing discussion as we prepare for the Run for the Roses this Saturday. So we'll be back to talk about that right after this.
Underdog. 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 Underdog.
All right, we're back here at the Underdogs, and we've been jockeying for position on who gets to speak about this next topic, but we let Peter go to town on some stats about horse racing, and Giant Killer style, Bracket Breaker style, he found some interesting stuff on long shots. Peter, how's your brain? What was it like diving into a horse racing rabbit hole, and what can you share with us?
Oh, well, will the results be boring? Nay, my friends, nay. let me say this, Jordan. You know that I turned down no opportunity in normal circumstances to wear a stupid hat or drink on air. But notice, I am not wearing a bonnet. I am not drinking a mint julep. And I stayed away. Let me put it this way. The only field I have ever encountered with where people go down rabbit holes the way they do with horse genetics is the Kennedy assassination. Okay, I don't know which I don't know which buffs are more crazy, but here's the deal. You know, winning a big picture, Jordan, winning horse racing times haven't gone up all that much in like 40, 50 years. So I have a lot of questions about whether this incessant focus in the industry on breeding. You know, people who are horse racing aficionados, they know more about mine that bird's ancestry than their own family trees, you know? And I'm not sure that really pays off. We went looking for some basic factors that winners have in common without having to get all absorbed in that stuff.
Right, because we're here, look, it's fun to place a couple bucks and watch the Derby with some friends. It's a fun couple minutes. There are people, who, like you said, who do this for a living and are going to crazy lengths to try to predict winner or a long shot. We're going to take a different approach, sort of the same way we check off buckets of things that upset minded college basketball teams have in common in the tournament. Peter, what's the first thing that you sort of found on the Derby that matters for either winners or long shots or both?
Okay, so let's keep two big things in mind. Okay, the Kentucky Derby is a huge race. It is the only American race with 20 horses in it. There are never fewer than 20 because they always pick two alternates in case somebody gets scratched. So there's a lot of traffic. Anything you can do, whether it's the talent of the horse or the talent of the jockey, to avoid getting jostled and obstructed and stay out of traffic will help. Number two, it's pretty chalky, Jordan.
So favorites? That's interesting, right? Because yeah, I would think a lot of horses would lead to chaos. And we always talk about how chaos is a quintessential factor in helping underdogs. But we're not seeing that in this race.
Well, here's the deal. 2013, the Derby switched to this exhaustive, comprehensive point system to qualify for this race. So you have to run. There's a series of 35 races across 7 states over 7 months. The horses that gain the most points from those races qualify. That means that there really aren't unknown quantities in the Kentucky Derby anymore. The 20 great horses. And so if you're a long shot, you're a long shot for a real reason. Like, you're not that good, or you're not. Anyway, the point is, you can't go that far and reasonably bet a long shot. And you want to look for horses that start out in the middle of the pack, not the very inside, not the far outside, and that know how to race in traffic. So they either set the pace or they're just off the pace, rather than having to turn from the outside and come in really wide and catch the leaders. Again, just like, it's a little shocking, there aren't really many crazy long shots that win the Derby. Mm-hmm. There aren't really many horses that come from nowhere or come from far and back in the pack or far outside. And now look, we all remember 2 years ago,
Rich Strike, right?
Rich Strike, 80-1 long shot, came out of nowhere and won. But that is such a crazy outlier. It's like one of those basketball games we see in college where we really can't explain why there was an upset. He's just one of those things that happened. In general, you want to root for a horse that's not that far away from being the favorite, not that far away from setting the pace, and has shown good finishing speed in his recent races. Now,
so I still like to bet on, you know, color or name or whatever. Is there anything else to convince me not to do that, and anyone else I should be targeting for an actual real reason?
Well, you know, the horse that checks all the boxes is Fierceness, but he's the favorite. Now, again, favorites have been pretty good value bets. They win about half the time. They're usually 3-5-1 odds. Fierceness is 5-2. That's not a silly bet, but we're not here to put you to sleep.
Speak for yourself, buddy.
The horse I want to bring up is called Forever Young. Okay. There's never been a winner from Japan before in the Kentucky Derby. But I think if you look at Forever Young, if you translate his race times from kilometers to the miles that we know, he's run very fast finishing times. He's a closer. And I think he's undervalued because there's less information out there about him, precisely because he's from Japan. Also, his trainer has a collection of 200 or 300 hats, and he likes to wear crazy hats. Yoshida Yahagi, he wore a purple, broad-brimmed purple hat at the Breeders' Cup. And so take a look at Forever Young. He's 10-1, little long, but not crazy, and would make history.
Anybody else that you like a little bit? Maybe I could throw in some sort of an Exacta or a Quinella or whatever the proper term is over at DK Horse. By the way, that it's a separate app. So if you want to bet the Derby, download DK Horse, check it out. It's got all the options you want. But
over
but
DK an- Horse, Catching Freedom is 8-1. He's known as a closer, but he's really like the second fastest horse in the race, and he's got endurance. He just crushed his rivals at the Louisiana Derby, and he finished that race running the last eighth of a mile in just 12 seconds. That's really fast. He was getting faster at the end. So if he hangs close enough for long enough, he could make the finish really exciting. Catching Freedom.
Is there anything else you found that's remotely, you know, interesting? I saw that in the notes you shared with us, 71% of Derby winners were either bay or chestnut colored.
Yeah, you can bet color. I was surprised that the percentage of people who respond to surveys saying they bet by a horse's name was only 7%. So but people still bet based on hunch or feel. But a lot of people still love the color, chestnut or bay. I personally like the white horses, but you don't see them that often anymore, Jordan.
Well, I bet my money on the bobtailed nag. You can bet on the bay.
What's the next line of the song? Oh, the what? Oh, the do long day.
Oh, I don't know. The Camptown Ladies it's been a long time for me. Any other factors at all that popped out as interesting to you and sort of like, again, looking at trends
just,
over time?
Just an omen. Post position, you don't really like to run from the inside because you get jammed. You don't like to run from the way outside because it's a longer race. Fierceness has got everything going for him, but he drew post 17. He's going to be the 17th horse in the 150 years of the Kentucky Derby. No horse has won from gate 17. So I think 44 horses have started in gate 17. They're 0 for 44. That cracks open the window a little bit, I think. Cracks open the gate, Jordan, a little bit for an underdog.
All right, so we're going to throw a little bit of a show budget on Forever Young, I think. And real quick, how do you plan to spend your Saturday afternoon in watching the Derby? Do you have a nice little setup here, or will you be eating oats? What's going on?
I was going to ask if there's a basketball game on, but that would just be rude. That would just be rude. I will probably remember about 3 minutes before the race is on that it's on. I mean, there's 5 hours of coverage. What are they covering for 5 hours, Jordan? I'm not sure. So I'm not personally that excited, but yeah, what the hell?
Oh, Well, on that note, we're two idiots, and we hope you enjoyed our podcast. We'll see you next week.